This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Hi, this is Jackie Forrest. Welcome to our podcast for December 20th, our pre-Christmas break edition.
Hi, I'm Peter Terzakian. Exactly. It's the perfect time of year to sit down in front of the fireplace, have a rum and eggnog, and just think about the new year. But we've done that for you, right, Jackie? We're going to do two things. We're going to look at the predictions that we made last year, a year ago.
Right.
And then we're going to flip the calendar into January of 2019 and talk about, I wouldn't call them predictions. I mean, predictions are really difficult to make, but more things to watch for and trends.
Trends, right.
Forward. Yeah.
The unknowns that might evolve into knowns over the course of the year. Well, let's talk about the things we identified about this time last year and how it all, they were unknown, but now we can actually tell you what happened. So the first one, and we will post our last year's unknowns onto the show notes of this podcast if you want to check them out. But the first one was collateral disruption coming from financial technologies that were altering fund flows. So this is things like ETFs.
Algorithmic trading.
Right. And so we're seeing, the point was that technology that automates the delivery of financial services is going to change the way people do fundraising, transfer money, manage money. And we're starting to see some signs of that for sure, even in the Canadian oil and gas industry.
Oh, more than signs. I mean, things like ETFs, exchange-traded funds. So these are things that are used in the financial services industry to bundle together a whole bunch of oil and gas stocks, say, for example, or a whole bunch of renewable stocks or so on. And what's happened over the course of the last few years and really accelerated again in this year, 2018, is the prevalence of basically non-human trading in the capital markets. And why this is relevant to oil and gas is because oil and gas, actually all energy, not just oil and gas, is that it is capital intensive. It requires a lot of money. So if there is collateral disruption in the financial services business, then that necessarily affects the energy business because it is, by definition, capital intensive, requires a lot of money.
Right. And one thing about these ETFs is they tend to favor larger companies, not going to smaller companies. And so there is a trend even in the Canadian public equities market. If you look at the S&P E&P index, which is the large caps in Canada, and some of the medium and junior, sort of all of the companies. And, you know, today Suncor and CNRL make up about half of the market cap of the whole index compared to about a third in 2014.
So the big companies, the biggest two companies in the Canadian oil and gas space are Suncor and Canadian Natural Resources. So they take up the bulk of the attention. They take up the bulk of the value on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. And that value is recognized dominantly by those algorithms that trade on a minute-by-minute basis, in some instances, microsecond-by-microsecond basis.
Yeah.
But what that means is that smaller companies over time have basically lost liquidity, in other words, active trading, because the robots are not really looking at that.
That's right. And, you know, if you take out the other big ones in Canada, like Husky, Imperial, Cenovus, and Encana, the rest of the market today is just about 20% of all the market cap on the exchange compared to about 40% in the past. Now, this isn't all because of ETFs. I think with the downturn, there has been a fleet to what is viewed to be more stable companies. Right. But I think ETFs are part of it as well.
ETFs and robotic trading, I mean, is a huge part of it. I mean, it used to be historically not long ago that small companies could go get a meeting in Toronto on Bay Street or Wall Street and talk to a human being about the prospects for their company. Well, I mean, you're not going to sit down with an algorithm and try and convince them that what your company's doing. I mean, it's the lack of the human interaction in the capital markets that is also affecting the liquidity, the ability to raise and access capital. I mean, it's not the only thing. You're right, the downturn and lack of market access and all those things that we talk about. We shouldn't forget, though, that there are structural changes happening in every industry, including financial markets, and that has ripple effects into the energy business.
Now, I will say there was also a lot of talk around this time last year about the potential for raising funds using these types of technologies, whether it be blockchain or crowdsourcing. You know, you don't have to go to the Toronto Stock Exchange to raise money.
Right.
Now, nobody in the Canadian industry really raised any money last year. So it may be these technologies still have value, but we just didn't see a lot of it.
No, they didn't. And they didn't. I only think there's one or two that actually dabbled with a Bitcoin. And then, of course, that fell through the floorboards over the course of the year, too. But the point is that there was some experimentation in the Bitcoin. And our second sort of thing to watch was watch that Bitcoin space, because it could pose an alternative source of capital and financing. I think it's safe to say, wouldn't you, that it was still a bit ahead of its time?
Yeah, well, I would say that the early 2018 will be always remembered potentially as peak Bitcoin, where you saw these cryptocurrencies get up very, very high, and they've fallen really far, so almost down two-thirds from their peak at this point. And, you know, I think while they may have, the cryptocurrencies in general may have lost their luster, the technology continues to advance for other uses outside of cryptocurrencies.
Right, right. I mean, it's not just about supplanting real physical paper dollars or digital money in dollars, euros, pounds, whatever, but the underlying blockchain technology is still alive and well, and in fact permeating behind the scenes transactionals technology.
That's right.
For example, like oil trading in Europe.
Yeah, so one really notable announcement in November of 2018 was a bunch of the European majors, including Shell, BP, Equinor, they developed a system called the VAKT platform, and they are trading a number of European crudes, and they've also got a number of the major banks involved as well. So now we actually have an example of oil trading without humans, without anyone in the middle, and the money being exchanged as well. So that's a huge accomplishment and a lot of efficiencies over the way it's done today. And then the other big thing that happened earlier in 2018 was here in Canada, where Guild One settled the first royalty contract here in Alberta with three companies, and ATB Financial was part of that as well.
Yeah, so there's royalties, there's trading for the commodities, and you'll probably see it in land transactions and other things coming. So that blockchain technology in terms of collateral technology that is altering the way that we do business is definitely something that started to take root in 2018. I think it's something to watch in 19 as well.
Yeah, we've got like real things here that you can see value in. There's also in Alberta, through Guild One as well, working interest payment work going on. So there's more coming in the new year.
Right. Number three was cartel and U.S. producer discipline. You know, the emphasis shifted really in 2018, markedly shifted. And the edict that was coming out of the investors was that they wanted to see companies make money. I mean, what a concept. They wanted to see oil and gas companies make money rather than just historically give them equity to be able to go drill more wells. And when, regardless of whether the price was up or down, they would continue to finance the drilling of wells with more equity dollars. They said, well, okay, invest your cash flow back into the ground and demonstrate to me you're making money.
Yeah, I want to see value. And I want some money for myself too. So there was this meeting in New York, apparently. It's a well-told story that a bunch of shale oil producers from the United States came to. Their investors kind of drew the line saying, you know, I want some cash back here. And so what you're seeing is a lot more money going back to investors. So that trend, the trend of giving more back to the shareholders has continued through the year. Even as the U.S. grew to almost 1.5 million barrels a day of crude oil growth, entry to exit 2018, they also increased the amount of share repurchases. For a group of U.S. shale oil producers, the massive increase in share buybacks.
I mean, this is really quite staggering. So just to be clear, that 1.5 million barrels per day. So the U.S. was producing, I'm just going to throw out round numbers, 10 million barrels a day, and it grew to 11.5.
That's right.
Yeah, 11.5 million barrels a day, grew that much without a lot of equity shareholder money. In fact, gave money back to the shareholders in terms of shareholder dividends. So, complete reversal and double trend, you know, surge in oil production in a jurisdiction that was declining secularly for, I don't know, like 20 years.
Right.
And then being able to give the money back. I mean, this is one of the biggest changes that we highlighted last year. And indeed, it's even surprised me in terms of how big it's been.
Right. And the fact that, you know, as prices got higher, you know, we saw quite high prices above $70 in the United States in Q3. We still saw that discipline of continuing to give money back to shareholders and not put all of it back in the ground, but yet they could still grow. So it turns out they can do both. It was always a question, could they do one or the other? Well, they've proven this year that you can do both.
But notwithstanding, you know, the recent issues here in Canada with the differential and so on, but even our companies are like mid-year, we're giving money back and by doing a lot of share buybacks as well, weren't they?
Yeah, we did a similar chart for Canada and we definitely saw the trend, although it was dominated by a couple of companies, mostly Imperial, did a lot of share buybacks and some other smaller companies.
Right.
So it's not quite as big of a trend as in the United States.
Yeah, certainly not with our smaller companies that weren't doing that. Yeah. Big question this year was will Russia continue to side with OPEC? In other words, this concept of OPEC plus, the core OPEC countries going back to the 1960s, and then the addition of Russia, not as a full-time member, but as a what they call a plus member, as a country that sided with the cartel to try and control the prices.
Well, so we got the answer December 7th. It was looking like Russia may not agree to continue with the alliance, but they did. And so they've agreed to make a cut into 2019, at least for the first half, that will help to balance the market. So the partnership has held so far.
Yeah, and we highlighted that it was a place to watch for this year. And indeed, it certainly was something to watch. And it's an important thing to sort of keep prices stable.
That's right.
As we go forward.
Yeah. So we wrote an early Christmas present for producers was this OPEC cut, because without it, I think we would have saw prices at WTI slip even further below $50, because without the cartel constraining their production, then you'd kind of have to have a price signal that would start to see the U.S. slow down.
Right.
And so their agreement to cut the production, balance the market, is going to keep the prices higher than it would have otherwise.
Speaking of OPEC, another place that we said we should be watching a year ago was the Middle Eastern geopolitics. You know, for most of 2015-16, I would argue even large part of 17, the notion of what's called a geopolitical risk premium, in other words, the price extra that consumers were paying for a barrel of oil because of the uncertainty and the instability in the Middle East, had actually winnowed down to almost nothing, right? Because there was so much oil in the world, so much oil in storage, that we said, well, it doesn't even matter if there is conflict that breaks out in the Middle East. There's still plenty of oil around. But we saw that geopolitical premium come back in 2018.
Right. It really was catalyzed by the sanctions against Iran that Donald Trump started, and the threat of taking over 2 million barrels a day off the market. In that scenario, there didn't seem to be a lot of spare capacity. We started to see more of a price premium. I think at this point now, with the view that Iran sanctions won't be as stringent as first thought, there's a little less concern about it. But that could come back at any time.
And two other countries within OPEC were quite unstable, Libya and Venezuela.
That's right. Libya did have a major drop in the middle of 2018, dropped about 40% from 1 million barrels a day down to 0.6 million barrels a day. But they did recover quickly. The bigger story was Venezuela, currently producing about 1.2 million barrels a day versus over 2 million barrels a day in 2017.
Lost 800,000 barrels a day. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, from kind of average 2017 numbers.
Sure.
So, you know, Venezuela has actually started to stabilize for the last two or three months, so it's uncertain where it's going to go from here, but definitely a big hole created. And that Saudi and Russia stepped in to fill. But with these Iranian sanctions, there was concerns about geopolitics, and that won't go away, I don't think. That's a constant.
No. Well, let's bring it home and talk about Canadian natural gas. The arbitrage, or the price difference between Canadian natural gas, exceedingly low, trading at barely $2, under $2 here domestically. Meanwhile, in the United States, trading for most of the year closer to $3.
Our price has been about $1.40 Canadian per gigajoule, about a third of the price that U.S. producers are getting if you're able to sell at Henry Hub.
The prices of natural gas in the United States have gone up over the course of the last few months.
That's right, especially with in the last month or so. And we're not seeing that in Canada. Yeah. Prices here remain low.
So the conjecture a year ago that we put forth was, you know, watch this space, that these arbitrages can't last, these price differences, because you can't have one market that's really cheap and another one next door that's expensive. But it's lasted and is probably likely to last a little longer.
Yeah, I mean, what has sustained our production in Western Canada so high in the face of such low prices is the fact there was a lot of gas that came from drilling from oil wells or wells that had this condensate in it. And so that actually meant that the production stayed very robust in the face of those prices. And I will say this year, it may look a little different if we have a little less oil drilling in Western Canada, and we may start to see some supply for gas start to decline. But I would want to highlight a report that was issued by the Alberta government just recently here in early December, with 48 recommendations, some short and long term. Worth a read if you're into natural gas in Western Canada.
48 recommendations. Okay, that's not just a read. That's a long read.
Yeah, well, it just shows you how many problems there are to fix. But the good news is there are some constructive things that I think could make a difference, and some of them are not years away. Mm-hmm. And so I am hopeful that we'll start to see this arbitrage close, but we didn't see it this year.
Okay. All right, good. Well, moving on to electric vehicles. I mean, we really can't have predictions these days without electric vehicles. A year ago, we talked about the Tesla Model 3 as something to watch going into the year, and certainly it came on and came on very strong. And we had a session on electric vehicles a few weeks ago. I think The Model 3 is a winner. It's a game changer. We talked about that in terms of especially its competitive space in that luxury mid-market section. I don't think it's going to let up. As I've always said, electric vehicles are probably going to perform better than expected in terms of adoption. But at the same time, don't confuse that with the end of oil, because combustion engine vehicles are also growing very robustly.
All right, last one, compliance with Paris. The accord was going to be 3 years old, and you predicted that the reality will start setting in, that the targets aren't that achievable. Interesting timing. I know now we're having the COP meeting here in Poland. Generally, the feedback is it's not going well in terms of being able to meet all of these targets.
No, I mean, you know, to be honest, it wasn't really rocket science to put forth the prediction that it's going to be very difficult to reduce emissions globally, and that 3 years into the agreement that it's unlikely that the targets are going to be met and that this is going to be problematic.
With that, let's look to the future and think about trends to watch in 2019. And we've got a number here. The first one is increasing investment in all types of clean tech, including ways to make oil and gas greener.
Yeah, clean tech is an interesting term. It's been around for about 20 years. And more recently, I would say in the last five, there's an association with clean tech as being energy sources that are not fossil fuel related, in other words, wind, solar, geothermal, and that whole set. But really, clean tech takes in a much broader definition. First of all, the definition of clean tech applies to many different industrial sectors, including agriculture, industrial, manufacturing, commercial, and so on. And broadly speaking, are a suite of technologies that reduce carbon emissions from all these different sectors.
But it could be water use or anything that reduces the environmental footprint.
Yeah. And there is a whole subsection under clean tech that is natural resource related, including oil and gas. And so what we are saying this year is that watch clean tech as a space that will likely garner more investment as a consequence of heightened climate change realities and narratives, and that oil and gas is probably not going to be excluded as much from that definition, that necessarily oil and gas has to be part of the solution. And we're already starting to see that in terms of some of the investment trends.
Yeah, I think there's a number of trends that support it. First of all, investors are looking for companies, including oil and gas companies, that are reducing their, they call it ESG risk. So that's environmental, social, and governance. E is a big one there. And, you know, you're starting to see a lot of pressure, especially from institutional investors, to show that companies are thinking about GHG and water use and understanding, will that be a business risk longer term? And so that's incenting companies to start to look at technologies that can reduce these footprints.
Yeah, the clean tech revolution, although, you know, the government is putting money into it, the Canadian government and the governments around the world, it's really being driven by the investors. It's being driven by Wall Street, Bay Street, financial centers in London, who are actually pushing companies of all disciplines that are emitting to be more transparent about their emissions and to adopt technologies to reduce them.
Yeah, and the government funding is significant. You know, in the U.S., it's hard to get Republicans and Democrats to agree on anything, but the one thing they do agree on is more R&D funding. And we've actually seen some big U.S. announcements about more U.S. Department of Energy funding for innovation, solar, advancing nuclear technology. In Canada, the same thing. In the 2017 budget, about $2 billion was committed over a series of years, not all in 1 year, to go towards clean tech. And that is also funding investments in oil and gas to reduce the carbon and the methane and the water.
So I think the what to watch for is more investment into this space. But equally, from an oil and gas perspective, what we should be watching are the companies that are actually adopting these sorts of technologies, because I certainly believe that the ones that adopt these technologies are going to be positioning themselves well for the 2020s.
Yeah, the company of the future is greener.
That's, I think, goes without saying in any industry. What about number two?
All right. We put OPEC and Russia back on there, and we didn't have it last year because still this group is very influential in terms of the outlook for the oil markets. And we believe with the agreement that was made here in December 7th that they will hold together, make these cuts for the first half. But beyond that, I think it's more of a question mark, especially if the U.S. continues to gain in their production.
Yeah, I mean, this is a tension that's out there. We've talked about it in previous podcasts, is that, you know, that staggering growth that we just talked about, actually, in the United States of 1.5 million barrels just in 1 year, means that if the demand is not pulling as hard, it's going to take market share from the OPEC and Russians.
Yeah. The only reprieve for that will be if there's some massive outage somewhere else that they can gain market share through that. Mm-hmm. And that's always possible. We just talked about Venezuela. Libya, they just had a small outage this week, about 0.3 million barrels a day, but it reminds you of how fragile that country is. And there's a big election coming up in February in Nigeria that could cause some instability. So, you know, the chances of this group holding together may be higher if there's some other market share that they can take from someone else who
I mean, my prediction is they will hold together out of necessity in 2019. But as you go into 2020 and 2021, depending on if the growth in the U.S. is sustainable, places like the Permian Basin and the output, that growth that we've seen there. Depending on what happens there, I think it's going to become more interesting to watch, actually, in the 2020s.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, the next thing to watch is Donald Trump. I thought that should just rate someone to watch.
So what's the prediction here? I mean, that he's going to be uncertain?
Well, definitely. Guessing what he's going to do is very difficult, so we can't even make a prediction here. But what I do know is what he does matters. No matter where you look, he is having a big influence on the oil markets, whether it be demand, whether the uncertainty he's creating with his trade war, or his changes to the fuel efficiency standards, the CAFE standards.
The environmental policies.
Yeah. On the supply side, you know, he's pressuring OPEC to keep the oil price low. He wants more production coming out of them. He also has a lot that he can do here around Iranian sanctions that we can't really predict. Is he going to become more stringent with them over the year? Are we going to see more Iranian barrels come off the market or not? So there's lots of things that he could do that could really change the trajectory of the oil markets in the upcoming
year. No, I agree. I mean, it's not much of a prediction, candidly, to say that he's going to be uncertain. But I think that the other thing to watch, of course, are his economic policies and where the economy goes, because the economy and global oil demand and energy demand more broadly is coupled to the global economy. And of course, U.S. policy does matter. So it's a space to watch.
For sure. Okay, let's narrow in here on trends in Alberta. I thought we'd highlight value add in Alberta, whether it be petrochemical, partial upgrading, or refining. We're getting more talk about refining here as well.
Right. I mean, really the impacts of the value add, in other words, the building of new refineries, petrochemical, or other types of plants that take our raw energy materials and add value to them, is really a long-term story. I mean, you can't build a refinery overnight, certainly not in 1 year like 2019. But the announcements that we hear in 2019 are consequential to the 2020s.
Yes, they are. And, you know, one advantage of having low-cost natural gas and butanes and propanes and oil is that it does create an opportunity. Mm. I will just say one caution, though. The reason we've struggled with value add in this province is because it costs us a lot of money to build these projects. So although you have cheap feedstocks and you can believe in that potentially, the capital cost to build your facility is a major other piece in the economic equation. And we have not really shown historically that we can build projects cheaply.
No. What does a refinery cost?
Well, I would just want to highlight the Sturgeon refinery. So back in 2011, it was supposed to cost $6.5 billion, which, by the way, for 75,000 barrels a day, that's still relatively high compared to what it would cost other places in the world. Mm-hmm. Turns out the current estimate is going to be closer to $9.7 billion.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when a project becomes 30, 40% more than what you thought, your margin is basically that you get the cheap feedstock, you change it into something of higher value. But if that capital cost you need to pay off goes up 30, 40%, it makes it very difficult to get a return on your investment. And so I think what we need in Alberta is thinking about how can we build these mega projects in a way that can be more predictable in terms of the costs.
Well, I'm definitely a proponent of building more value add in this province. I think longer term, the realization that we have all these resources beneath our feet, and we have wind and solar too. This notion that we have in abundance, cheap energy, cheap feedstocks, really forces us to think differently about what we can do with these resources. And I think adding more value just makes imminent sense. But you're right. We've got to make sure that the projects are built on time and budget. Otherwise, it's a money-losing proposition.
Right. Well, and I mean, there's some positives. I'm hopeful that we can figure it out. First of all, we have a lot of engineering companies that I think are much more competitive than they were in the past that may look at lump sum agreements like we saw on the LNG Canada project. And so that gives some certainty in terms of cost. There's a lot of work that's gone into modular. So where you build more of the parts of the plants off-site in a controlled area and you can predict the cost more than the stick build method that's typically used in Alberta. And so I'm confident and hopeful that we'll figure out a way to get our capital costs working. And, you know, these projects make a lot of sense in that case.
Well, they do. I mean, the good news here is the realization that we have in abundance, the sort of low cost and declining cost because of technology resources. And I think that 2019 will be a year where industrial companies outside of Alberta are going to start waking up and saying, wow, this is kind of a unique place. But anyway, we'll see.
We'll see. Okay, the next one. Canadian market access improvements.
Okay, well, this is a tough one. Yeah.
Well, but I know I feel more confident because we talked about it on our previous podcast about how this episode that we've just gone through, it's very painful in the last 6 or 7 weeks, has resulted in a bigger commitment to crude by rail. Mm-hmm. We're almost going to have a Keystone XL on rail here in terms of the potential capacity that we could be moving. We've got new pipelines coming. And even in the last week, Enbridge, which is the major company that moves most of the crude oil out of Western Canada on their mainline, announced that they can even make some more space on the mainline. And then there's this other pipeline they have called the Express Pipeline, which they also announced they probably can add some capacity on as well. So things look to be moving in the right direction.
They are moving in the right direction. I know it's painfully slow and it's very reactive, unfortunately, but hopefully we'll see that. We'll probably see some news on TMX. Are you optimistic about that?
Yeah, definitely. We're going to get more clarity on TMX, hopefully more, and we'll probably get more clarity on Keystone XL in terms of the likely timelines. And I do want to talk about a market access when it comes to natural gas. I talked about that study that the government put out about solutions. LNG is definitely one of them. And I'm going to go out there and make a prediction. We had the LNG Canada announcement. Mm-hmm. I'm predicting that there's going to be news on another large LNG project in the new year. It makes a lot of sense. We've got the cheap gas we talked about. Shell, when they made their announcement, talked about the fact we can deliver into Asia a dollar cheaper than the Americans. We have all these advantages. And the world needs more natural gas. There's an opportunity
there. Well, we've got the lowest cost natural gas in the world right now. It's just almost coming out of the ground for free. I mean, what is it trading at, a dollar or some ridiculous thing?
Yeah, I mean, we've averaged $1.40 or so for the last 12 months, and we're even lower right now, Canadian dollars per gigajoule. A third of the American price. So that's part of why, you know, we at these prices, by the way, we're way more than a dollar ahead of the Americans in terms of our competitiveness. And I think that's going to bring more investment here.
Yeah, well, you know, it's really a follow-on to that issue we raised a year ago in our write-up, which is that arbitrages don't last, that necessarily the market has to figure out ways of equalizing the price here, which can't be so low relative to, first of all, American prices and then global price. I mean, global prices are, what, $8, $9?
Yes, that's right. So, sometimes even as high as $12, depending on what's going on with the market.
The U.S. price is, let's call it $3 or $4, and here it's one Canadian. I mean, it's just ridiculous, this notion of the arbitrage. So necessarily market forces have to come in, and hopefully 2019 will be the year that things start to turn around.
All right, that's a big prediction for natural gas. Things are going to turn around.
Okay.
Okay, last prediction, or not really prediction, but trend to watch is digital oil and gas. I am going to predict that we're going to move from PowerPoint slides to digital reality.
Okay, a lot of talk, much as we had a lot of talk about Bitcoin and blockchain last year.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk. A lot of buzzwords are being thrown around.
But this is not about blockchain and Bitcoin. This is more about things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, and so on.
Bots.
Algorithms doing people's work.
That's right. It's like a computer robot sits in your computer, and you know anything that a human does to click.
What, like this, opening PDFs and things like that?
Yeah, or any kind of back office processes that are repeatable. So for instance, if you have to fill out a regulatory form every month by, you know, taking data from three different databases and putting them in a form, if it's the same process every month, why not get a bot to do that?
Right, which is basically a computer algorithm that learns how to do that. Now, this is nothing new, really. I mean, it's happening in other industries. So what you're suggesting is that it's coming to the oil and gas business.
And, you know, it's already here. We're starting to see some demonstration of it. You're starting to see companies do pilots. But I think this year is the year that it's really going to take off, where we're going to start to see more visible examples and real returns.
So in processes, like you say, back office processes, such as accounting and finance and things like that. So what you're suggesting is that we have processes that improve productivity so that people can do other higher value productive things in the office, lowering the cost of running a business.
I mean, it doesn't end there. That getting your G&A cost, your
general administrative
kind of cost of running your business down is really important. As we've seen with these low prices we've had, those that have the lowest cost structure are the most resilient. But I think there's also a ton of value in adding more revenue. You know, oil and gas wells don't always run at 100% of their productive capacity.
Right.
They're often running at much, 90% or something like that. And so with these types of things like artificial intelligence, predicting when we might have outages before they actually happen, optimizing the well and the back pressures so that we can get the most production we can out of the well.
Selling into the highest value market, like knowing which value market to go into.
Right, yeah, some of these automated training. So finding ways to squeeze more money out of the business, whether it be through the cost side, but also through the revenue side.
Right.
And I think we're going to start to see more tangible examples. So it's not just all fuzzy PowerPoint or not clear what the value is. We're going to start to see real applications.
Now, what you've talked about mostly is what I would call the above ground processes, but below ground, in other words, where you drill and try and find the oil and gas and produce it most efficiently, there's also a lot happening too as well with machine learning, artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, there's things that computers are better than humans at. And when it comes to these large sets of data, whether it be interpreting five or six different types of subsurface data and finding the patterns, they're finding that these technologies find oil that humans' eyes miss.
Right.
And so I think you're going to see more there.
And being able to drill down, say, 3 kilometers and out horizontally 3 kilometers, and being able to do that with extreme precision in a much more efficient way, reducing the risks along the way, really lowers costs and improves productivity.
Yeah. Well, that's a good one to end on, actually, because that's a positive.
Right.
I think that I'm really looking forward to 2019. We're going to have improving market access. We're going to see the takeoff of digital and gas, more investing in clean tech, which is going to drive companies to become more clean and green.
Right. I mean, this really speaks to an energy industry that is starting to transition to more efficient processes to reduce cost and better products, which is lower carbon, to be able to compete into the 2020s.
All right. We want to wish you a great Christmas break. We're taking a break now, too. Our next podcast will be recorded on January 11th.
Well, we're all looking forward to a holiday. So thanks to all of you for tuning into our podcast. We really appreciate your patronage, and we look forward to lots of interesting conversations into 2019. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.